Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
You know, it's funny. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. When I hear the first few lines of a song and it goes, black sunrise, shadow coming over the skies because you don't know where it's all going to go, it makes me think of Heart for some reason. On that note, we have a very fabulous guest for you, ladies and gentlemen. Former writer for Investigate magazine, who's joining us live slightly south of the earthquake zone. His name is Ben Vidgen. Is that how you pronounce it?
Not too bad, Dave. It's Vidgen, just like pigeon but with a V.
Just like pigeon but with a V. All right. Well, my name's Vinny. Starts with a V and it ends with an N-E.
Excellent.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about yourself, because recently we've had this earthquake and there's been a lot of speculation about it being HAARP, and HAARP facilities are apparently here in New Zealand now. Nobody knew, and I've still not seen so far so much as a snapshot of a New Zealand HAARP facility yet.
All right, Vinny, well, what I'll do, mate, is I'll give you a little bit of background about myself, and then I'll explain how I kind of come into the HAARP situation and how it relates to the earthquake in Christchurch. So by way of introduction, my name is Ben Vidgen. I'm the editor of Deadline Magazine, which is a small newspaper set down here in the South Island of New Zealand. We like to think we've got a fairly impressive reputation for doing scoops on major stories, which we've broken well ahead of our competitors. Today I've written two books on the underbelly of Australia and the Pacific's called State Secrets 1 and State Secrets 2. The first one was a bestseller. And I have a degree in political science and history from Canterbury University, where I specialise in political violence and terrorism. Simultaneously, while doing this, I served as a soldier in the New Zealand Territorials, which is a little bit like the American National Service. I worked in artillery and infantry, and I served in a number of roles, including field, counter, and arty intelligence. For those who don't actually know what that means, intelligence work is basically clerical work. You take notes of incidents, these are marked on a map, filed as situation reports or sit reps, and then we allows us to collectively create a visual and chronological snapshot of the battlefield. Arty intelligence, which is kind of getting a bit closer to our subject of HAARP, is basically the study of ballistics, and it's largely done by looking carefully at the crater of what your opponents left behind, working backwards to spot and identify the forensic signature, which then helps identify the precise nature of that weapon, its abilities, its limitations, and the methodology behind this is the same whether you're talking about a pea shooter or an atom bomb. So let's begin with how this all relates to HAARP. The day after Boxing Day, I made an entry on Facebook, which was then posted to several other websites, which expressed my concern on the possibility of further dramatic seismic activity occurring in the Canterbury region in the near future. My concern was based on seeing the photograph by Lloyd McFadden of ball lightning over Christchurch, which was taken on the eve of the Boxing Day quake, which then appeared on the front page of the Christchurch Press. I've been basically expressing concern about these fireballs since about 2005, when we noticed that the same phenomenon was taking place over Western Australia and preceded the events just prior to the tsunami earthquake on Boxing Day 2004. I know a lot of people might actually find what I'm about to say about plasmoids links to weapons research a bit hard to swallow, but what I'd like them to stress is that there's increasingly an acceptance for the theory that stimulation of ions in the upper atmosphere may be stimulated by seismic activity in the Earth's core. In nature, you know, examples of this include situations where you get extremely magnetic active lightning storms taking place over areas where volcanoes are active at the same time. Likewise, passing asteroids, solar storms are all known to enhance the Earth's natural magnetic field, a little bit like a tuning fork, which apparently can be also triggered, which can, like a tuning fork, which apparently can also trigger seismically sensitive areas. Not surprisingly, much of this is monitored or recorded by the insulation organisations, which I'm going to talk about today. Indeed, much of the research has been carried out as legitimate scientific research with a clear civilian goal in mind. Fireballs are simply a symptom of a wider condition unfolding, and fireballs are produced as the charged electrical magnetic fields come in contact with energy released from the seismic activity, much in the manner that fine coal dust will spark over a fire long before the coal ever comes in contact with the actual flames.
And just one here, it's a seismic activity.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I did, how this all relates to the situation is in 1995, one of these so-called fireballs exploded with about the force of a Hiroshima bomb over Perth. Now, this is when things started to get interesting because at the same time, there was a geologist in Australia called Harry Mason, and what Harry did was that he tracked this supposed meteorite, and he tracked it down to the epicentre, Western Australia, where it actually caused a 3.75 earthquake. Now, there's a number of interesting things about this fireball, which we started to see happen time and time again. The first one was that another of the symptoms that we quite often get reports of is you'd hear reports of sonic booms, and, you know, the next day there'd be an article in the newspaper saying, oh, such and such observatory have said that it was a possible meteorite. Well, the thing is, meteorites actually travel at above 25,000 miles an hour, and the sonic boom you're actually occurring is when something's actually just breached the subsonic barrier and is moving forward. So in other words, you're talking about something that's moving slower than 25,000 miles an hour and then picking up with sufficient speed to break that sound barrier. So in actual fact, you know, whenever you've got reports of sonic booms and fireballs, there's something fishy going on there to begin with. Now, what also happened at this time frame is that in 1993, we saw the creation of High Altitude Atmospheric Research Project, which was initially installed in Alaska. It was financed with $10 million from the Pentagon, and it was backed by a guy called Mark Begich. Ted Stevens, but why I mention Mark Begich is because his brother, actually Nick Begich, is the author of a book called about HAARP, and he's been fairly vocal on the subject for about two decades now. Now, you know, before I get a bit anywhere further carried away, Vanessa, are there any questions you want to ask me for, or should I just keep moving on?
Well, I don't really have any questions. Will, do you have any questions?
I'd say keep going, Ben, yeah.
All right. So what happened was that Harry started to turn around and he you know, found that this particular meteorite actually had taken place at the same time as an earthquake. The earthquake occurred pretty much about 3 kilometres away from a farm, which would later claim some bit of a media attention because it actually belonged to a cult that was based in Japan. They'd taken over the farm 35 days beforehand, and in 1995, this cult would reach headlines all around the world when they were the first organisation to carry out a terrorist attack involving biological attacks on the Tokyo subway. Now, Harry sort of got quite interested in these guys, and he sort of established quite a number of interesting things about these guys, and all of which actually resulted in him being asked to testify before a congressional investigation on this cult, because they believed actually that the cult lay behind the cause of the earthquake, and that actually had weapons that could actually trigger earthquakes. Around about this time, I think it was about 1998, William Cohen, who was then Secretary of Defense, made a sort of rather interesting remark, sort of saying that terrorists had possession of weapons that could cause earthquakes, and I suspect that he may have actually been referring to the cult. However, what Harry wasn't entirely convinced that the cult was behind it, because what he started to examine was that he discovered that there was quite a strong correlation between these fireballs and also activities occurring within this area in proximity to electronic warfare stations. For example, about 3 kilometres away from where the earthquake actually struck in Western Australia in 1995, you've got Laverton, which is basically Australia's largest electronic warfare station, and it's effectively kind of a sister station of HAARP based in Alaska. What also Harry found was that, you know, at the same time, whenever there was sort of these fireball activities, there was also a lot of activity occurring over Exmouth, which is sort of to the west and the north of Australia, which is another electronic warfare station. And this pretty much all coincides with my research independently, where I found a couple of interesting things. And the first one relates directly to the kind of the issue of HAARP and fireballs, which is, there's a guy down here in Otago called Craig Rogers, and he's been studying the various storms that take place in the upper atmosphere. They have names like Blue Jets, Sprites, Red Storm, and he was actually hired to kind of find out what happened if a shuttle flew through one of these things, and he discovered that if it did, it had about a 1 in 100 chance of basically having its electrics, you know, fried and having the whole thing blow up. But what Craig also noticed was that when he was doing his research in West Australia, they use what they call a multi-spectrum camera to kind of conduct their research on the upper atmosphere. And what he was finding is that, you know, wherever there were these electronic warfare stations occurring, there were also kind of these kind of storms taking place in the upper atmosphere that were apparent to actually have some actual interaction. And interesting enough, if you actually go to HAARP's own site, and around about March 04, they've got these photographs of HAARP ticking away in North Alaska, and there's aurorae borealis taking place as you normally do, but there's also these fireballs. And the interesting thing is they only appear in the frames when the transmissions are on.
When you say HAARP's own website, what is that website?
Well, you have to excuse me right now, but I don't actually have it in front of me. But if you actually kind of go along and you Google just the words high altitude atmospheric research site, you'll actually find that one of those websites is actually listed as actually the official website of HAARP itself. And HAARP as I understand, in the United States, is basically comes under the cover of the National Science Foundation. But what you also discover is that a lot of the finance behind HAARP is actually comes directly from the military and is under the umbrella of what they call Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA.
Yeah,
and if you ever look around on the website, you'll basically come across their own site, and it's fairly informative. It acknowledges the fact that the military is actually behind it. It acknowledges that HAARP actually does have military applications, or that part of the research has been conducted towards to looking at, you know, whether the upper atmosphere can be manipulated for use in communications or electronic warfare. And this is an interesting thing you actually find is that, you know, from about 1993 all the way up to last year when HAARP became fully operational, there are these little kind of segments where HAARP goes actually up for funding. And every time you see one of these sort of windows occur where it gets new injection of cash, in Western Australia, you're marked by the sudden eruption of these specific fireballs, which we're now seeing over Christchurch. And, you know, when you look at the direct nature of what you're actually examining, you've got fireballs that always take place over installations. You have fireballs that or meteorites which can form into formation or zigzag and change direction, which I've never heard of a meteorite doing beforehand, are normally accompanied by sonic booms, which indicates that your meteorite's travelling less than 25,000 miles per hour, and they normally will take place, you'll see this. One of these events occur that normally within about a period of about a week to a couple of days afterwards, you'll have a quake directly occurring. Now, in New Zealand...
So are we talking about real, concrete, scientifically verified evidence that an artificial quake, a man-made quake, was brought down on Christchurch?
If we turn around and we start to say, you know, is there solid evidence that an earthquake, a man-made earthquake, took place in Christchurch, you'd have to turn around and say, no, there isn't proof. What you've got is a series of correlations, which is a little bit like the relationship between smoking and cancer. You know, no one can actually prove that smoking causes cancer, but when you start adding up all the correlation patterns, there's a pretty strong kind of relation here. And when you look at Christchurch, you know, what I did was, at the time when I turned around and started kind of realising that, hey, you know, there was something interesting going on here, what I did was I went through and I started looking at a series this was like a normal artillery attack. What were the signs to indicate that, you know, where this had come from and who was behind it? So what I did was I started by looking at seeing whether or not at the time that the earthquakes that took place in Christchurch on January 20th and September 4th, I find out, first of all, was HAARP active at that particular time? And the answer on both occasions, yes, it was. What we also find was that there's a sudden surge in seismic activity also taking place in Alaska at the same time that we have seismic activity taking place in Christchurch. From about September all the way up until now, what we've also seen is we've just seen a massive spike of these reports of of sonic booms or fireball activity taking place over the entire South Island. It begins in September and it's been just doing nothing but basically escalate. We've got people who have taken photographs. The people like Lloyd McFadden have actually filmed it. So we've got this footage, Ben.
I mean, I've been really trying to get some of this footage of people seeing, you know, aurora borealis type phenomena in the sky, red skies, fireballs. Do we have this footage that we can compile in a logical way?
There are two cases of the footage. One is Lloyd McFadden. I'm trying to actually secure footage from him at the moment because the footage that appeared on the front page of the Christchurch Press, that's actually only a frame taken from it because he's a cameraman, he's not a photographer. So Lloyd's currently got it and we're trying to access it. I have actually also have a backup source who actually also has film footage of up to about six of these ball lightnings taking place in the Targa. And I don't know the precise date at this stage, but the roundabout date of around about mid-October 2010.
Have you seen any mainstream media report on these instances?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, I've told you the case of the Christchurch Press, they have a fireball on the front page. Of course, all they're doing there is going, oh, look at the curious weird lights in the front, happening over Christchurch. They don't actually do a correlation. There is one report that takes place on September 9th on the New Zealand Herald, which is written by an eyewitness who was present during the second earthquake, and he also reports the first earthquake, and he also reports seeing these lights before, and he's the guy that's done some really interesting research, basically showing that, you know, these fireball activity actually has been shown and taken place before earthquakes going back as far as 1968. The reasons he puts forward, he doesn't tie into weaponry research, and you know, there are natural occurring circumstances where this occurs. The point that I'm making is that what we're seeing is up until, like, you know, 3 months ago, the cases of media actually even acknowledging these fireballs occur before fireballs was far and few between. Now we're seeing a massive spike of these sightings taking place. And if you actually backtrack as far as basically 95, which is the Perth case that I made reference to, you're just seeing a massive escalation of this phenomenon taking place, and more people were reporting it. Where, interestingly enough, there's no squeak or mention of it being made prior to, I mean, it's only really been in the last 2 months that they actually even started to acknowledge that, guess what, they're actually, these storms taking place in the upper atmosphere. Now, as far as physical locations go, in New Zealand we've got, or in South Island, we've got two installations which directly relate to HAARP. And again, you know, by going and having a look at the website, you'll find very easily on that, you know, this is officially so, which is the first site is based down in the Cargill. It's called Tiger, T-I-G-E-R. And this basically is designed to kind of monitor what's happening in the upper atmosphere and the very interesting space weather. It's tied into what they call the Superdawn radar network, which I'll explain and talk about a little bit further. And the second site,
After the break, sorry to cut you off there. Our very, very special guest is Ben Vigen coming at us live south of the Quake Zone. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Crossed the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcast and everywhere, live on the streams at AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Our ridiculously awesome and special guest from the bottom of me cockle places, it's Ben Vigen. Welcome back, mate.
Hi, guys. How you doing there? Hey, while you're on the way in the break, the installations we were talking about, the heart facilities that are based in New Zealand, the one down in Invercargill is referred to Tiger. This is the Tasman and Antarctic Geospace Environmental Research Facility. It lists its job as weather forecasting and telecommunications, research into weather forecasting and telecommunications systems interferences. This ties into what they call the Superdarn Network, and there's another facility based in Christchurch itself called Birdling Flats, which is sort of about 15 to 20 k's away from the epicenter. Don't know too much about Birdling Flats except for it lists itself as being involved in firing pulses against the into the electromagnetic atmosphere.
Have you seen pictures of Birdling's flat?
Yeah, I have seen Birdling Flats. It looks like very, very similar to Harp, and you've got a big whole array of antennas. It's not a facility that I don't know a great deal about. We haven't managed to kind of get in there and kind of look at the configurations or the way that it's actually set up. It's actually the Tasman Antarctic Geospace Environment is the one that we actually know a lot more about because it's been publicly touted on the radio and on the newspapers since it's established about a decade ago. It's pretty much done what most facilities have happened in the South Island, which have had military backgrounds. It turns up, makes a very public facade of it, but it never actually mentions the military funding behind it. South Island actually got a pretty good history of this. There was an activist back in the 70s, a guy known as Owen Wilkes, very famous in his time, and he actually kind of traces New Zealand being involved in geo-warfare experiments in Blenheim back as far as the 1960s and the late 60s. He also broke into Mount John, which is part of the observatory network which runs throughout New Zealand, in the 70s, discovered that this was being used for missile defence back then. At that time, they kind of Americans pulled out and said, oh, we're not doing that anymore. But then in the 1980s, the same institution got busted by students in the 1980s and discovered that, lo and behold, once again they were being funded by the military. And in the 90s, through declassified documents, we now know that that same facility was again being used for research into cruise missile development.
Well, if your idea is to deceive people, then obviously you just tell them the exact opposite of whatever it is you're doing.
Exactly. And, this is even true of the scientists that actually work on these facilities because, you know, I've spoken to a lot of these guys, and if you ask them, you know, is all system tied up with weapons, say, no, it isn't. But, you know, what these guys don't really appreciate is that what they're doing is they're being paid to only, you know, fulfill part of the equation. They don't know what the bigger picture is. And again, you know, Owen Wilkes is quite interesting because if you go and you look, he wrote a book which is actually available in the library called Protests and or in the National Archives. And, you know, he does a very good job of actually looking at how much New Zealand universities have been used for biowarfare research and next generation Star Wars defence research, going all the way back to the 1960s. He lists which universities were behind it and how much money they were actually receiving. And a lot of this is tied up with the Antarctic program. What you actually find is that the communication systems that they use at McMurdo and their new base, which you want to ask me a few questions about, at Scott Amundsen, that communication system directly ties into the HARP facility in Alaska. It uses the same communication system that ties into the Vandenberg missile-related system, and they're all overseen by the same organisation, the National Science Foundation. In Antarctica, a lot of this material is collected using remote observatories. This is actually relayed through a system at the South Pole known as Marisat GOES. The Marisat GOES in turn fires its material up to a satellite known as F2, which sits in an Antarctic or South Pole orbit, and that in turn then fires through to Pennsylvania University, which was the same university which was basically providing the front cover for the US's defense funding back in the 1980s. All of this money is funded and provided by the United States Navy Space and Warfare Research Facilities, which is known under the acronym SPAWA.
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 Star Wars and space destroyers and all of this jazz. Well, it sounds absolutely out of this world, and it so is, isn't it?
well, yes and no, because you know, at the end of the day, my theory is that the science behind HAARP isn't actually that particularly complicated. And the biggest thing that people need to understand is that HAARP itself is not a weapon. It is simply the triggering system for want of a better word, man piggybacking back off the back of Mother Nature. In the upper atmosphere, there are these storms occurring all the time. And as far as I can make out, my research indicates that basically what the US military is doing is it's simply piggybacking off the natural magnetic field and pushing and poking where it shouldn't be doing so.
Just look at the steer, isn't it? Can you explain for our audience, and particularly for anyone who's interested in this Christchurch incident, just exactly how HAARP works to these ends? You know, how HAARP can influence tectonic movements, how HAARP can influence storms, how it can affect both the atmosphere and the
we'll work our way backwards in terms of, if you look at the beginnings when HAARP was first put in 1993, the Federal Aviation Authorities made the United States military and the managers of HAARP put in a warning because they knew that even at low levels, there were only 18 antennas went into HAARP when it first was installed in 1993, but that was sufficient that anybody that had a pacemaker, it could trigger it to actually, basically fail. They had to put up warnings against light aircraft because the interference in the electrical magnetic background that HAARP caused was sufficient to bring down light aircraft. So, you know, there is no doubt in my mind, even early on in the place, that HAARP can very easily used to basically fry or interfere or jam the electronic components on aircraft. And it's really interesting. When you start actually backtracking over the number of aviation crashes that have occurred in the last decade that have specifically occurred where there's been a sudden and unexplainable mass electrical failure, when you go and you start looking at the passengers list, it's amazing how many of those guys that are on those aircrafts are actually electronic warfare engineers. And this is even true of the shuttle. When the Challenger crash in 2003, I was quite intrigued because they were carrying out research into sprites at that time, and the guy that was actually conducting the research was Colonel Ilon Raymon, former head of the Israeli Air Force's Weapons Research and Procurement Division, and he was the guy, actually handling the payload at the time when the crash occurred, and the person who was the commander of the shuttle at that time was William McCool. And if you go and you look at his bio, you discover that he, not only was he a specialist in electronic warfare, but he actually taught the U.S. fighter pilots, and actually, he was their chief tactician on electronic warfare. Now, the next step up is you've got Ken HAARP play around with the atmosphere. Well, go look around. There are plenty of commercial models already actually out there on the market that show you that this technology can do exactly that. So I don't see, how people have a problem when some small, less than a kind of 10 million corporations doing the same thing for Dubai. Why they think that possibly the US military that's got, unfathomable pockets isn't capable of doing the same thing. The third and final thing is the question is, can HAARP actually trigger earthquakes? Now, there's a really good example of how this can be done that appears on the documentary Invisible World, which is compared by the gentleman that runs Top Gear. I think it's Nigel Hammond, is it? Otherwise known as the hamster.
Richard Hammond.
In the program Invisible World, what he does is he shows you have a large propeller that's moving through the ocean, and as it's moving behind it, you've seen all these little molecules of oxygen being thrown up behind the back of the propeller, appearing like little bubbles of oxygen. And as they kind of get towards the surface, or as they get the energy of the propeller turns it out, these bubbles get bigger and bigger until they finally explode. And what Nigel points out is that what you're seeing here is a process of cavitation, where literally the engines are heating up the water molecules, causing them to expand and explode and release huge amounts of energy, which is in comparison to the amount of initial leverage that actually takes place. Well, HAARP does exactly the same thing, except it takes place in the upper atmosphere. On the ground, these antenna farms basically supercharge or ionise the atmosphere. I suspect that you can then bring in things like chemtrails to enhance the signal transmission of this process. All of this stimulates the ionosphere. This is targeted using a multi-spectrum lens, such as that's available on the Hubble or that have been, you know, put on the shuttles in the past. These target the systems. These storms that are taking place in the upper atmosphere, in turn, using ground directional radar systems on the ground, which is set up in triangulation format, they'll target the area that the seismic area that they want, or the area that they want to seismically activate, and then this area over a period of days will stimulate at the magma lava, all the magma below, causing it to heat up, and then you end up having the same effect as you have with these huge propellers behind the back of boats, except, of course, instead of water that we're talking about magma lava, which is basically an energy form in its own right.
Well,
what do you think about this fault line that's formed there? What's your explanation about this fault line?
Now, you're talking about in terms of the Christchurch that we have an earthquake taking place on a place where previously there wasn't a fault line?
Exactly.
Is that what you're asking, Will?
Yeah.
Well,
I just wondering what your take is on that. You know, it seems unlikely that the opposite side of the South Island, which there's a massive fault, we have this huge earthquake.
I
just wanted to know also, were there reports of chemtrails on the day too?
Well, I'll answer that in two parts. The first part is, the new seismic fault line that's taken place in the South Island, I mean, the South Island, for listeners outside of New Zealand that don't know, does actually sit on a fault line, and you know, and faults can appear or be all over the place. So it's, you know, to be my own devil's advocate, you know, it's hard to say whether or not that has any bearing on HAARP whatsoever or not. However, what's more interesting, and this is what I'm curious about, is the fact that that new fault line appears. We have months and months afterwards new seismic activity occurred, which we refer to as shockwaves. We then have the activity taking place on the September the 20th, which, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but that doesn't actually take place on the new fault line. It actually takes place on another fault line. So how come that one's referred to as an aftershock? In which case, if it's not an aftershock, it's an earthquake. We've got, what, two major earthquakes taking place within a city within 6 months? You name another place around the world where two earthquakes of such devastating consequences have taken place. I think you might find Japan would be a closest example, but, you know, nothing like
but
this.
They claim they predicted it, though. They claim they warned of such an incident.
Well, are you saying that the mainstream warned of such an incident?
Both mainstream and other sources. There was a guy named Ken Ring who
The mainstream claimed that they knew this, but they said that, like, they led us the information like after the event. And one is curious, as a South Islander and someone who's lived in Christchurch, curious to know that if they actually knew this was going to take place, as they now are claiming, why didn't they, A, warn Christchurch residents of the risk, and even if that meant simply ensuring that Christchurch residents were much more safety aware, that they had gone around and, you know, nailed things to the wall and taken things, you know, risks away or put in contingency plannings, but to turn around and say after that, oh, we knew that was going to happen, but we didn't bother to tell the people of Christchurch, I just find it absolutely outstanding. As far as the chemtrails...
It just would have killed the economy, is my bet. I mean, if you told all the businesses and all the people who are living there that, hey, there's going to be another enormous shake coming and it's going to destroy all your property, would people have relocated a tad more? And that would have drained huge amounts of money away from the central city. So in order to protect the economy by allowing it to be destroyed later...
$16 billion that is now drained in the recent quake.
Pardon? You'll have to say that again.
I'm saying, Vinny, that, you know, that might have been their logic, but at the same time, look what's happened now. And that, again, that excuse doesn't stack up, because we've just lost in the South Island, in less than 6 months, we've lost $20 billion out of the economy. And, you know, for readers, for listeners outside of New Zealand, you know, it's not just the earthquakes that have hit the South Island. In the last 12 months, we've had storms cause about $500 million damage in Southland. We've had financial collapses of Ponzi schemes that have lost more than $1 million to different Ponzi schemes.
And we'll be right back, because, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. Ben Vidgen is our guest, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio. And incidentally, the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. You can check out our fabulous archives. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally, the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Oh, yeah, it's business time. Our very special guest is Ben Vidgen. And one thing I wanted to know, Ben, Claire Swinney tells me that you said to her that there's a transmitter on Waiheke Island.
Well, the transmitter on Waiheke Island is one that we're actually trying to get more information on at this stage. I've got a friend of mine that works in the for TVNZ that at one stage had access to a light aircraft, and he's done a bit of flying over the area, and he's of the opinion that there's a large antenna farm based there on the Waiheke Island that we want to find a little bit more about. The reason why it was actually posed as a question to Claire, and the reason why I asked Claire about the if she was aware if there was any activity on Waiheke Island is that throughout New Zealand, both the North Island and South Island, probably beginning around about 2007 and escalating, we've also been hit by the phenomena of chemtrail activity in the south, and in this part of the world. And what I've managed to actually ascertain is that, you know, wherever else where we know that the sprains are taking place over the South Island, we can find that there are installations. Like at the beginning of the top of the South Island, you have Waihaupai, which is a signal targeting system. You go to Christchurch, you've got the Birthing Flats. Then you've got the Mount John observatories. Then you go to Invercargill, where you've got the Tiger facilities. So all from one end of the South Island to the other, you've got a series of installations, which are basically all tied up with the American radar and electronic warfare network. We know in the North Island, however, that we're also getting chemtrail sightings in the Northland, as well as we're getting reports of animals turning up dead in different parts of the North Island, which is a phenomenon happening around the world. And in fact, I understand that Biosecurity right now have actually issued an 0800 number for anyone that finds more than 20 birds in their backyard in the Hawke's Bay region.
Well, it's happening more common, and this dovetails. With copious amounts of birds' death all over the world, and even in Pakistan, there were millions upon millions of shellfish getting washed ashore every day.
Yep,
there was something happening to life.
They're also happening in California. Yesterday, there was a whole marina that about a million fish washed up on their beaches up there. When we looked at that situation, which is kind of known on the internet as their flocalypse, What strikes me is that the two areas that we turn around and see these events occurring is either on states that back onto the Gulf of Mexico where the BP spill occurred, or else in areas around the world where we know that there are HAARP or HAARP-like technologies based in those regions. The connection to HAARP is that my understanding is that the materials that are used for the spraying consist of alloys which are naturally conductive for sending signal transmission or signal suppression, and that they use these sort of chemtrails as primers for when they're using kind of when they want to send out communications or they want to kind of get their HAARP toys activated, then you'll normally see that there's a in the weeks leading before, and you'll see a spike in chemtrails activity taking place at the same time.
So that happened in Christchurch, didn't it?
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, and again, you talked about, you know, whether there's any of this has been reported at all. The ODT have actually been doing some pretty sterling work. The ODT is the Otago Daily Times, which is, by the way, the only daily newspaper in the entire New Zealand that's not owned by an offshore company. But the Otago Daily Times on early around about December, they ran a couple of letters to the editor about the chemtrail, and they were originally quite dismissive, but what then happened was that there were so many people in Otago that sent in photographs of this chemtrail reporting that they started to change the tune. And what's interesting about the photographs that were taken in Otago is that they allow us for the first time to see the dispersal of chemtrails taken from multiple angles by people who have recorded the time, and actually it's then been traced back to Operation Deep Freeze, which is the US base in Christchurch where they fly all their flights to Antarctica. It was traced back by Met Service to a C-5 Galaxy aircraft, and Met Service also backed up basically the logic, you know, behind the people who sent the photos into the ODT, saying, well, you know, these are not contrails. Contrails do not spread and disperse in the manner that these have. And MetSurf said, well, you're completely correct. Well, the weather conditions that are happening at that time, that wouldn't happen. Deep Freeze said, oh, this thing was, you know, going down to Antarctica. But interesting enough, the contrails, one of the letters to the editor, you know, took the Peter Drew was the name, had the initiative to actually, you know, go and check out the satellite photos on online and discover that actual contrails actually stop at the end of the South Island. And even though so that kind of puts the Deep Freeze's explanation kind of sinks that one at the same time. So the third article that they actually read, that the ODT ran, was actually kind of outlining the fact that, yes, chemtrails and contrails are a completely different thing. And what's interesting in the South Island is that, you know, while the rest of the world kind of tends to dismiss this, we've got some really good political leaders down here, and we've got Marion Streep and Nelson, who has lent her support behind the Clear Skies, which is an activist group in Nelson that have been actively, you know, documenting and being really, really proactive about the activities that occur over Nelson. And Nelson's right next door to the Waiapa signal station, so we're not surprised to see that there's massive sightings in that area there. And the other person that deserves to be applauded was Kevin Hayes. Kevin Hayes at the time wrote a letter to the Minister of Environment, Nick Smith, when he was the Mayor of Kaikoura, on behalf of Kaikoura residents, who again were shocked about seeing, you know, all this activity taking place over the area, which again, Kaikoura is right next door to the Waiapa signal station. Kevin Hayes sent in a letter to the Minister of Environment saying, well, you know, what's this going on? Who's behind it and who's paying for it? Nick Smith tried to fob it off as being contrails. And Kevin Hayes sort of basically wrote back a letter saying, well, you know, mate, don't insult my position, don't insult my intelligence. I run a highly successful business. I've travelled all around the world. I've spoken to people overseas that have, you know, and seen this firsthand, and I've seen it firsthand here, and your explanation is crap. And what's more,
And unfortunately, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Could you please plug your website before we have to let you go?
Yeah, well,
it was such
an amazing
interview. Thank you.
Well, my website is www.deadline.net.nz. We'll be having an interesting article on chemtrails happening. We'll go up probably in the next 2 weeks, and we'll be following it up in another 2 months with our special investigation report into Hart Christchurch earthquake.
Hey, Ben, I'd like to thank you so much and keep up the great work. And also, could you please add me on Facebook so I can have a little chat to you?
Yep, no problems at all. Well, I'm more than happy to do that, and I've seen you out there, and you're very active, and thank you very much. We need more of people like yourself, for both of you, Benny. And thanks for having
me.
Not everybody would agree with you. You're listening to the Benny Eastwood Show.
Non-busted ill covering them. Don't let them wear you down, I say.
Yeah. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening. Without your listenership, we would be nothing. We love you very much in a very awesome way. And if you want to check out our archives and the other fabulous guests that we've had on our show, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. There's literally a plethora of knowledgeable individuals that you can listen to that we've had on this program. So I urge you to take advantage of it while it's free. We'll see you again sometime. Time.